KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
That is why today I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
The travel ban is back. President Trump has banned people from 12 countries and placed partial restrictions on 7 more. We'll speak to the Center for Constitutional Rights and get an update on Mahmoud Khalil, still in jail in Louisiana. Then the United States has once again vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote, 14-1.
The United States has taken the very clear position since this conflict began that Israel has a right to defend itself.
We'll speak to longtime peace activist Kathy Kelly, who's just entered her third week on the hunger strike outside the United Nations.
We want the United States to act with conscience, and if it doesn't, we have to give voice to the shame, the utter shame of prolonging and exacerbating a war whose victims have been over and over and over again children.
Plus, as Israel attacks another hospital in Gaza, we'll look at how the Israeli medical establishment has responded to the targeted destruction of Gaza's medical system. And we'll speak to the British journalist Carol Cadwalader about taking on what she calls the broligarchy.
You know, some people have been talking about the idea that there is now an oligarchy in America in which incredibly rich and powerful men are now aligning around Donald Trump for their for power, for their own enrichment. And broligarchy is this specific set of tech bros who are acting like an oligarchy, like we saw in Russia around Putin.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump signed a new travel ban barring citizens from 12 countries from entering the United States. A similar ban during Trump's first administration sparked major protests at U.S. airports across the country and numerous lawsuits. The new ban targets visitors from Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and the Republic of Congo, which is also known as Congo-Brazzaville, not to be confused with the Democratic Republic of the Congo. New travel restrictions will also be placed on visitors from Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. Amnesty International criticized the ban as, quote, discriminatory, racist, and downright cruel, unquote. The White House released a video of Trump speaking about the ban.
The recent terror attack in Boulder, Colorado, has underscored the extreme dangers posed to our country by the entry of foreign nationals who are not properly vetted, as well as those who come here as temporary visitors and overstay their visas. We don't want them.
We'll have more on this story after headlines. At the United Nations, the United States Wednesday vetoed another Security Council resolution calling for an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote was 14-1, with the other permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, France, and the UK, all supporting the ceasefire. Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour responded to the U.S. veto.
This draft resolution had a simple goal: demanding a ceasefire that would allow the beginning of the monumental work needed to end the horrific humanitarian situation, to stop the genocide, to release hostages and prisoners, and to get the Israeli occupying forces out of Gaza before they get a chance to implement their plans to destroy our people.
Hours Hours after the UN vote, Israel attacked the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City. Three Palestinian journalists were killed, a fourth was seriously wounded. This marks the eighth time Israel's targeted the hospital. Meanwhile, the shadowy new U.S. and Israel-backed aid group, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, has suspended operations for a second straight day after over 100 Palestinians were shot dead while seeking aid earlier this week. This is a survivor.
We only wanted to feed our children. They're the ones who need food, not us. We're used to going without, like during Ramadan. That's why we rushed to the aid distribution site. They tempted people with promises of help, but in the end they opened fire. Why? What did we do to deserve this?
A new CNN investigation backs up eyewitness accounts that Israeli troops opened fire near an aid distribution site Sunday, contradicting denials by Israel. Meanwhile, in southern Gaza, the Israeli military has recovered the bodies of two Israeli Americans, Judy Weinstein Haggai and her husband, Gadi Haggai, who'd been killed in the October 7th, 2023 attack. On Capitol Hill, seven members of the group Doctors Against Genocide were arrested Wednesday inside the Hart Senate office building. The doctors said they were attempting to deliver to lawmakers what they called a prescription to end the forced starvation of children in Gaza. Here in New York, a group of veterans and peace activists have begun their third week on hunger strike outside the United Nations. We'll speak with one of the hunger strikers, Kathy Kelly, later in the broadcast. And in London, pro-Palestinian protesters formed a red circle around the British Parliament Wednesday. Iyas Al-Qassam of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign took part in the protest.
Palestinian lives do matter, and everybody here is saying that if you're a human with a conscience, you cannot watch a genocide, and worse than that, you cannot continue to arm a genocide, and that's why they're here.
In Ukraine, Russian drone strikes killed five people and wounded six others in the northern city of Priluki. The dead included a one-year-old child found under the rubble. Elsewhere, Russian bombs struck the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson, heavily damaging a government administrative building and injuring two people. And at least 18 people were injured when Russian drones struck apartment buildings in Kharkiv overnight, with two children among those injured. The attacks came after President Trump said Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to retaliate for Ukraine's drone strikes on military airfields, which reportedly struck more than 40 Russian aircraft. Putin's threat came during his 75-minute phone call between Putin and Trump, their second call in recent weeks. Trump wrote afterwards, quote, "It was a good conversation, but not a conversation that will lead to immediate peace," Trump said. On Tuesday, Ukraine announced saboteurs had successfully set off explosives planted underwater at the foundations of a key bridge connecting Russia and the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The explosion briefly halted traffic. It was Ukraine's third attack on the bridge since Russia's invasion in 2022. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has rejected a key demand of the Trump administration's proposed nuclear deal, saying Iran must be allowed to continue enriching uranium for peaceful purposes. Over the weekend, the Trump administration proposed a deal that would have allowed Iran to continue enriching uranium, but only temporarily, something Khamenei called unacceptable.
If we have 100 nuclear power plants but no enrichment, it won't help us, because nuclear power plants require fuel. If we can't produce this nuclear fuel within the country, we'll have to turn to America. They may set 10 conditions for supplying nuclear fuel.
Human Rights Watch is calling for an investigation into the U.S. bombing of an oil port on Yemen's Red Sea coast on April 17th that killed 84 people and wounded more than 150 others. 49 of the dead were port workers. Also killed were several truck drivers, two civil defense workers, and workers' family members, including three children. Human Rights Watch said the U.S. government's decision to strike the oil facility while hundreds of workers were present shows a, quote, callous disregard for civilian lives, unquote. The Trump administration has escalated its attacks on Columbia University. In a letter to the nonprofit that accredits Columbia, the Education Department's Office of Civil Rights asked for the school's accreditation to be canceled. and accuses Columbia of violating the rights of Jewish students by, quote, acting with deliberate indifference, unquote, toward reports of harassment during campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, President Trump Wednesday moved to block nearly all international students from attending Harvard University, taking a separate approach this time after a federal court in Boston blocked a similar effort by the Department of Homeland Security last week. Trump's new effort invokes national security as a rationale. In a statement, Harvard officials rejected the freeze on international scholars as, quote, yet another illegal retaliatory step taken by the administration in violation of Harvard's First Amendment rights, unquote. The Trump administration's proposed cutting funding for tribal colleges and universities by nearly 90%. A move that would likely force most or all of the nation's 37 tribal schools to shut down. ProPublica reports that even before Trump's proposed cuts, tribal colleges were receiving $250 million per year less than the inflation-adjusted amount they should receive. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights once called tribal colleges, quote, the most poorly funded institutions of higher education in the country. President Trump's order doubling tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from 25% to 50% took effect Wednesday. In response, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum accused Trump of violating the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement and said Mexico would soon announce countermeasures.
Si no hay un acuerdo, pues ya nosotros estaríamos anunciando la próxima semana.
If there is no agreement, we will be announcing measures next week. Because our responsibility is first to protect employment, Mexican workers, and second, the steel industry.
The Congressional Budget Office reported Wednesday that President Trump's sprawling domestic policy bill, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, would add $2.4 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. The CBO projects nearly 11 million people will lose health insurance if the proposal becomes law. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baracus filed a federal lawsuit claiming false arrest, malicious prosecution, and defamation over his arrest last month by masked federal agents outside an Immigration and Customs Enforcement jail. Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee are calling on Republican Chair Jim Jordan to condemn the actions of Homeland Security agents last week when they handcuffed and detained a staffer for New York Democratic Congressmember Jerry Nadler. The incident began when Federal Protective Service agents knocked on the door of Congressman Nadler's Manhattan offices demanding to be let in, saying they were searching for protesters. One agent accused Nadler's aides of, quote, harboring rioters, unquote. Staffers have been observing protests outside an immigration court in the same building and invited two protesters inside their office. Congressmember Nadler later told CNN the agents handcuffed and detained his staffer, even though they lacked a warrant.
This was totally unacceptable, and they needed the warrant. And my office is a congressional office. It's a completely separate branch of government, a co-equal branch of government with the executive for which they work. And they had no right to come in. They had no right to disregard the co-equal branch of government, which is to say, the Congress.
And in El Salvador, judges ordered the detention of prominent anti-corruption lawyer Ruth Lopez for 6 months while she awaits trial. She was arrested last month over allegations of embezzlement, charges she says are trumped up. On Wednesday, Lopez shouted to reporters as she was led into a courtroom in handcuffs for a closed-door hearing.
I want a public trial. The people deserve to know. Whoever doesn't owe doesn't fear.
Ruth Lopez is the head of the Anti-Corruption and Justice Unit and Cristosal, a leading Salvadoran human rights group that has frequently criticized the policies of the Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. President Trump has signed a new travel ban barring citizens of 12 countries from entering the United States. A similar ban during Trump's first administration sparked major protests at U.S. airports and numerous lawsuits. The impacted countries are Afghanistan, Burma, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, and the Republic of Congo, which is also known as Congo-Brazzaville, not to be confused with the Democratic Republic of the Congo. New travel restrictions will also be placed on visitors from Burundi, Cuba, Laos, Sierra Leone, Togo, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. Trump linked the new travel ban to the recent attack in Boulder, Colorado, when an Egyptian-born man used a makeshift flamethrower and incendiary devices to attack a crowd of people taking part in a weekly walk to honor Israeli hostages in Gaza. Trump, however, did not add Egypt to the list. On Wednesday night, the White House released a video of Trump speaking about the ban.
Very simply, we cannot have open migration from any country where we cannot safely and reliably vet and screen those who seek to enter the United States. That is why today I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
For more, we're joined by Bahar Azmi. He's legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which challenged the first Trump travel ban, along with other groups. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Bahar. Explain the significance of what President Trump did last night.
It's significant on its own, but more so in a continuum with a series of, you know, sort of showcasing almost day by day or week by week, some new immigration policy that, you know, effectuates their sort of evangelical white supremacist fantasy about this country. So there's, you know, this shipping people to Guantanamo, that former security theater, then Seacoat, then coming after Palestinian students. Then attacking, you know, descending ICE onto schools and courthouses. And now this, the a new iteration of a Muslim travel ban that is going to be devastating to families from these countries who seek immigration visas or in some cases even tourist visas. And regrettably, the lesson from the last time is that the Supreme Court seems amenable to these claims. The Supreme Court, and really almost only this Supreme Court, seems amenable to claims of the executive that he has enormous immigration-based authority to, quote, secure the borders or, quote, determine what's detrimental to the United States. By excluding people of color.
And so, Bahar, can you explain, you mentioned the Supreme Court. There was a 2018 decision, which people say, legal experts have said, will make this travel ban harder to challenge than the 2017 one.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's right. So people will remember the chaos from the first travel ban that was particularly tied to Muslim majority countries and the chaos it caused in the airports. And virtually all the lower courts determined like what was very obvious to any human being, which is this was discriminatory. It's discriminatory on the basis of religion and national origin, namely excluding Muslims alone and therefore should violate the Constitution. John Roberts, as he is wont to do, pretends that what's plain to every sentient human being is not actually the case, finds that it wasn't really driven by racial or religious animus, and then invoke the massive authority that this Supreme Court has given the president to under provisions of the Immigration Nationality Act. To exclude, quote, aliens, exclude non-citizens, even when it seems very patently on the basis of race or religion.
And so, Bahar, can you explain, this particular ban includes exemptions for visa holders and permanent residents. That's unlike the first ban. Do you know why this exemption was put in?
Yeah, this is a little bit less legally a little bit less obviously unconstitutional than the first ban, and includes more countries that are not Muslim majority. It permits claims for asylum, exempts lawful permanent residents, and I think it's just an effort to make it a little bit more tailored legally They perhaps have learned their lesson that they can achieve the shock value and the you know, inflicting trauma on parents and families by doing it in a more tailored way that the Supreme Court would ratify.
I want to ask you about one of your clients, the detained Columbia student protest leader, Mahmoud Khalil, who came up in New York City's mayoral debate last night ahead of a primary election this month. This is one of the leading contenders, State Assembly member Zohran Mamdani.
He should be set free. He should be at home with his wife, Noor, and their young child. And the fact that he is still in Louisiana is an abomination. It's an attack on our First Amendment. And it is clear, another example of Donald Trump weaponizing the very real issue of anti-Semitism to then throw Palestinian New Yorkers into detention facilities and not even tell us what the crime is that they're charged with.
That's Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, who's currently polling second to former New York City Governor Andrew Cuomo, who notably echoed Mamdani and agreed Mahmoud Khalil should be released from detention and, quote, shouldn't have been detained in the first place, unquote. This is a change from Cuomo's response to Khalil's detention in March, when he didn't call for the Trump administration to release him and also criticized what he called the anti-Semitic agitators at Columbia. Tell us the latest. You represent Mahmoud Khalil. Talk about what's happening in immigration court in Louisiana and federal court in New Jersey.
Yeah, thanks, Amy, for bringing this up. Yeah, Mahmoud Khalil is one of a number of student protesters who were targeted by ICE. We're nearing almost to the day, the 3-month anniversary of his arrest and abduction by ICE officers in front of his eight month pregnant wife, and spirited off to our immigration gulags in Louisiana, a private detention facility in the middle of Louisiana, 5 hours from New Orleans and 1,500 miles from his family. We have a team of lawyers challenging his detention in two forums, in the immigration court, where the Department of Homeland Security is suggesting he is detainable and can be deported because the Secretary of State, Rubio, has determined in an utterly conclusory fashion that his presence in the United States would be adverse to the foreign policy interests of the United States. And when that charge became vulnerable, they added some pretextual and made-up charges suggesting some misrepresentation on his application. In the immigration court, it appears that the Homeland Security has all but abandoned the claim of misrepresentation because it's factually preposterous and is just doubling down on this really chilling Rubio finding that he and other students are deportable just simply on the dear leader's say-so, a kind of Soviet-style diktat. And so separately, we are in federal court in New Jersey, challenging the legality, that the unconstitutionality of the Rubio determination as a violation of the First Amendment, and because it's so void, so vague that that it violates basic principles of due process. A district court judge last week found that the Rubio determination as applied to Mahmoud is likely unconstitutional. It's so vague and indecipherable that it, you know, can't stand constitutional muster, and invited his lawyers to submit evidence on other questions before the court, namely, how is this causing him harm and what is in the public interest? And last night, we filed an avalanche of evidence on those two points that we'll be making public later this afternoon.
Maher Azmi, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll cover your 2 p.m. news conference, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which challenged the first Trump travel ban, along with others, part of the legal team representing Columbia student protest leader, still detained, Mahmoud Khalil. When we come back, the U.S. has once again vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The vote, 14-1, will speak to well-known peace activist Kathy Kelly. She's just entered her third week on hunger strike outside the U.N.
In was so disposed toward a mission yet unclear. Advancing pole by pole, Pajin breathed into my ears. Obey this simple code. When road was paved in gold, when road was just a road, am I blinking? Yeah, such a woeful schism. The pain in our existence was not as I envisioned.
My Blakean year, Patti Smith in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
At the United Nations, the United States vetoed another Security Council resolution calling for an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The final vote was 14-1. This is Dorothy Shea, acting U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
The United States has taken the very clear position since this conflict began that Israel has a right to defend itself, which includes defeating Hamas and ensuring they are never again in a position to threaten Israel. In this regard, any product that undermines our close ally Israel's security is a non-starter. This resolution would undermine diplomatic efforts to reach a ceasefire that reflects the realities on the ground and emboldens Hamas.
Meanwhile, Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour criticized the U.S. vote. This was his response.
One would have hoped that these minimal demands that are dictated by humanity, by legality, by morality, would have received unanimous support. But unfortunately, they were faced with a veto.
The U.S. veto comes as a group of veterans and their allies have entered their third week of a fast for Gaza outside the U.N. This is Lieutenant Joy Metzler, an active duty second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force who's applied for conscientious objector status.
The blatant violation of international law, that the U.S. and breaking its own laws. And I joined the military because I wanted to uphold justice. I wanted to protect our country. I wanted to protect people. And really, what the genocide in Gaza opened my eyes to is that the U.S. military or the U.S. military and the U.S. government are just not interested at all in either of those things. And so all of that came together, and I said, I can't be in the military anymore. This isn't what I had been brought up to believe it is. It's the U.S. has been a destabilizing force for years now, and so I'm doing exactly what I had been taught to do, which is stand up for justice. But now I see that standing up for justice means being on this side with all these people out here in this fast who are really fighting, actually fighting for people in the Middle East and in Gaza to be able to lead lives with dignity.
Joy Metzler was approved for conscientious objector status in April.
And this is one of the Fast for Gaza organizers, Mike Ferner. He's the former president of Veterans for Peace.
I was a Navy corpsman during the American war in Vietnam, where we killed over 2 million people. I worked in a Navy hospital and tried to put together the bits of humanity that came back from Vietnam. So I've seen what happens to people in war. And it has never left me. It can't leave me. And so Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, these things happen. And it just tears me up. And not just me, but many, many people all over the world, particularly Veterans for Peace members who have seen what war does. And you can't get that out of your mind. And when you see the hourly feeds from Palestine that we've been getting, you can't take it. I mean, I can understand completely why Aaron Bushnell did what he did. Not many of us have that much courage, but we want to do as much as we can to stop this. So that's why we're doing this fast.
For more, we're joined in our New York studio by another hunger striker, Kathy Kelly's board president of World Beyond War, longtime peace activist, pacifist author, who's been arrested more than 60 times, has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize a number of times. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Kelly. Kathy Kelly, how are you feeling? You're in the third week of your hunger fast. Talk about why you're usually outside the UN hunger striking.
Well, thank you, Amy and Ramin. Yes, third week. But, you know, we wake up each morning and we don't worry about whether or not our children have been buried under rubble overnight. We're not drinking poisoned water. We're not surrounded by rubble. We're not dealing with the horrible traumas that people in Palestine and Gaza are dealing with. And so we want to take what action we can to encourage, to focus world attention, because the leaders of the world now have an opportunity. It's really an unusual opportunity to press forward beyond yesterday's very, very unfortunate vote, the fifth time the United States has vetoed a Security Council resolution. There is a mechanism called Uniting for Peace, which would allow the General Assembly to bypass a U.S. veto. And the member staffs of the United Nations General Assembly permanent missions understand this mechanism. They really are working hard. But if we all push, as has been happening, we really do see it, don't we, all around the world. I mean, in Ireland, Trinity College, they just severed, because of the student pressure, trade relations with companies and universities in Israel. But what the member states of the United Nations could do now is enact this Uniting for Peace resolution and not just make denunciations, but give it teeth, really implement what has been implemented in the past. I mean, in 1956, the United States worked with the Soviet Union to implement this resolution because they didn't want France and the UK to invade the Suez Canal area. They wanted to have control. So it is doable. The other thing is that the nations of the world ought to recognize that Israel is flaunting international law in so many ways. I mean, possession of nuclear weapons flaunts international law, and Israel has at least 90 thermonuclear weapons stockpiled. And the European Union is now investigating the other horrendous violations of human rights that have been happening. And upcoming is the plan for a two-state solution conference hosted by France and Saudi Arabia. France hasn't even recognized the statehood of Palestine yet. And we're familiar with Saudi Arabia as a predator nation, as one that has been pretty greedy and avaricious in the way that it has taken from the Yemenis and imposed drastic warfare. So what is going to happen? Is it possible that they're going to try to use the United Nations to sort of give a good cover to what might become a collection of Bantustan-like states that would not recognize the Palestinian right to self-return, Palestinian right to self-determination, Palestinian right to survival at this point?
Well, Kathy, of course, as you mentioned, the U.S. vetoed this resolution. They've done so multiple times. What are you calling for now? How long do you intend to continue your hunger strike?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, we're out there for 40 days, so we're just really at the beginning part. We want that Uniting for Peace resolution to be invoked, and it is a mechanism that's possible. We also think that there are plenty of ways that they could give more teeth through using economic trade measures being canceled. The European Union is investigating that, but they can move faster and more firmly so that we give teeth to the denunciations that have been given. And of course, there's much more alliance. The United States is quite isolated. And perhaps within Israel, Israeli people longing for the release of the hostages will start to listen to some of their own reservists who are saying, no, Prime Minister Netanyahu is sabotaging
the hostage release and ceasefire possibilities, and they won't go to Gaza. There are 20 waiting to be sentenced, most likely.
How many of you are fasting, and what would lead you to end your fast?
750 worldwide. We're on the corner of First Avenue and 45th Street. And right now, we are usually about 12 people that are core fasters here in New York. But there are others in Australia. We're hearing from people in China, Ireland, Canada, Mexico. So this is a fast that grew very, very quickly. Phil Tottenham, as Mike said, concerned about the life-risking options. He didn't want to do what Aaron Bushnell did because he said, well, I was afraid to do that, but he said, I can fast. And so that's really what got this going. What would make us stop? Well, certainly if there were a permanent, unconditional, immediate ceasefire and all distribution of aid was being facilitated by the United Nations, which knows how to do it, and the Gaza Human Foundation would not be any longer relied on. They're luring people into food distribution centers and then shooting them in the head, in the torso. And so we want to see the full distribution of food and a complete end to any United States weapon shipments to Israel.
Kathy Kelly, we wish you the very best. Kathy Kelly is board president of World Beyond War, has just entered her third week on a hunger strike. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Earlier today, Israel attacked the Al Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City. It marked the eighth time the hospital has been attacked over the past 600 days. Three Palestinian journalists were killed at the hospital. A fourth journalist was seriously wounded. We turn now to look at how the Israeli medical establishment has responded to Israel's systematic attacks on Gaza's health system.
We're joined now by the co-authors of a new article headlined The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. Joining us in Tel Aviv, in Israel, is the medical anthropologist Guy Shalev, who serves as executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. And in London, the Israeli political scientist Niamh Gordon, who is the first director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He's a professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Niamh Gordon, let's begin with you. Talk about what you found.
What we found is that the support for Israel's assault on Gaza, the genocidal assault, including the decimation of its medical system, including the killing of 1,400 health workers, including the detention and disappearance of 400 medical doctors and healthcare workers, including the torture of detainees, it has been supported by the Israeli medical establishment through and through, whether it's from the top, the Israeli Medical Association that represents 95% of Israeli doctors, the other healthcare associations, including the Nursing Association and the Psychological Associations and their ethical committees. We found that that hospitals did not accept Palestinian detainees who were wounded and needed medical care. We found that doctors inside hospitals were unwilling to treat Palestinian detainees or did not demand that the shackles from their legs and their arms and their blindfold be removed before they were treated. We found that doctors did not provide painkillers to Palestinians, claiming that they should suffer from the pain. We found doctors in Israeli hospitals that posted genocidal messages on their private social media accounts. We found persecution of medical doctors and nurses, Palestinian medical doctors and nurses in the Israeli establishment. So there's a whole system, the whole medical establishment inside Israel has been actually supporting Israel's assault on the Palestinian people and particularly on its healthcare system.
Now, Guy Shalev, you are joining us from Tel Aviv. You are the executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. It is this organization, your organization, that gathered testimony from 24 of these Palestinian health workers. Can you explain how the testimony was collected? And, you know, the key things, what most surprised you about what you found?
Right. So first of all, it was impossible to collect testimonies for many months since the beginning of the war. In the beginning, there was no access to detainees. We could not send lawyers to visit them. We could not have any kind of supervision of their conditions of how they're being held. After approximately 6 months, we could have started to send lawyers to visit them to collect the testimonies. And then what we heard was just impossible to hear. Doctors that were detained while they were doing their work in hospitals, other doctors who were detained while crossing checkpoints across Gaza after the soldiers found out that they are doctors, and then being taken to facilities in Israel. Most famous, probably infamous, is the Sde Teiman facility, being subjected to torture, medical neglect, violence, starvation. Three doctors and one paramedic died in Israeli facilities. These are four out of the 90 Palestinian detainees who died in the past 20 months. And we tried to figure out what was the reason why doctors were targeted in such a way. And we realized that in their investigations, they were asked to provide information or kind of reveal the structure of hospitals and what they know, which is a violation of the international law and protection of medical workers. You cannot detain a medical worker for the purpose of collecting information if you don't have any evidence that they violated any law. And in fact, most of these people were held without a trial, without charges. Many of them are still held, approximately 150 medical personnel are still held in Israeli detention facilities.
And Guy Shalev, you also point to an extraordinary statistic regarding the number of Palestinians who work in the Israeli medical establishment. You say Palestinians comprise 25% of all doctors and almost 50% of all new doctors and nurses in Israel. So can you explain how they have been treated in the months since October 7th, these Palestinians who work in Israeli hospitals?
Right. And yes, first of all, these are amazing numbers. And this is the outcome of a long process of many years of Palestinians studying medicine, both in Israel and abroad, and choosing medicine as their kind of profession for the reasons that many people in the world choose that profession, but also for the reason that many minorities and people of marginal communities choose medicine, because they see that as an opportunity for social mobility, an opportunity to be accepted as equal. And that is why we see a lot of doctors in the Israeli medical system. And unfortunately, this ideal of a system that is that considers them as equal was never a reality, and definitely not after October 7, when there was basically a witch hunt of Palestinian medical workers in the Israeli system. Social media profiles were scanned to see whatever they are posting there. And then a very large number of doctors and medical workers were subjected to hearings and other kind of processes, including firing doctors and medical workers for just the most basic social media posts, such as supporting children in Gaza, or just feeling compassion for the people of Gaza. And it created this atmosphere that basically silenced and censored an entire group of doctors and medical workers in the Israeli system.
We're speaking with two of the three authors of the piece, The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. We're speaking with the medical anthropologist Guy Shalev in Tel Aviv, and with Niamh Gordon, professor, speaking to us from London. The third author is Dr. Osama Tanous, a pediatrician board member of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He was advised by his lawyers not to do the interview. Guy Shalev, can you explain why?
Yes, this is exactly what we just talked about. It is just too risky for a Palestinian citizen of Israel to be publicly resisting the war, publicly criticizing the Israeli establishment. And we've seen cases, for example, Professor Nader Ashalhoub, a very famous professor in the Hebrew University, who participated, was interviewed in a podcast and was later had to resign from the university for very basic kind of critical opinions, professional critical opinions she had over the Israeli policies in Gaza. So the risk is unfortunately high, and we're sorry that his voice is silenced once again, because Niamh and I are here and Osama is not.
And Professor Niamh Gordon, if you could say, what exactly are you calling for?
Well, I think what we managed to show in the article is the complicity of the Israeli medical establishment with Israel's egregious violations of international law, including the Genocide Convention. And what we also know from past experience and from what we detail in the article is that change will not emerge from within without pressure from without. And so what we think, or at least I think, is that the international medical establishment and medical community needs to put pressure on their counterparts in Israel in order that they raise their voice against Israel's policies. The Israeli medical establishment in general identifies with Israel's colonial project and puts the colonial project over the most basic ethical principles of their profession. And that, we think, needs to change. So one very practical idea is that students and staff in research institutions in the United States, Canada, in the UK, in Europe, map the kinds of partnerships their institutions have with Israeli medical institutions, with Israeli research teams, with Israeli medical corporations, and demand from their own institutions to cut these partnerships, to cut ties with these partnerships, to end the contracts with Israeli medical corporations, not as a principle, but as a strategy, saying to their Israeli counterparts, we'll be happy to carry out these partnerships again, we'll be happy to do business, but only after Israel stops its colonial project, after the Palestinians receive liberation and self-determination. It is time, we think, that the international community boycott the Israeli establishment in order to bring about change and to stop this genocide we're witnessing.
Niamh Gordon, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political scientist, the first director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. He's professor of international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London, speaking to us from London. And Guy Shalev, executive director of Physicians for Human Rights Israel, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. We'll link to your new article, The Shame of Israeli Medicine, published in the New York Review of Books. Next up, we go to the British journalist Carol Cadwalader, talking about taking on the broligarchy. Back in 20 seconds.
History's not made by presidents or popes or kings or queens or generals or CIA kingpins running dope. History's not made by nine-robed men or billionaires
lawyers or bankers. It's not made by them. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. A black Spartacus heart attack machine. I might throw a little money around, wondering who can be bought. Some might find they're cheaper, and some stronger than they thought.
Well, Black Spartacus Heart Attack Machine by Tom Morello here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with the award-winning investigative journalist Carol Cadwalader, who is covering one of the key issues of our time, taking on what she calls the broligarchy, the new age of tech bro oligarchs. Cadwalader gained international recognition for her expose on the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal in 2018. She worked for The Guardian and Observer at the time.
Carol Cadwalader now runs the Substack, How to Survive the Broligarchy. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's quite some time for you to be here in the United States. Mm. You'd usually be in London. You see what's happening in Congress right now, where they're talking about keeping AI, the state's hands off AI, states in the United States, for 10 years. And you also see the leaders of AI in this country, including Elon Musk, as basically, in some ways, running this country. How do you take on the broligarchy, and why do you think that's important?
Because I think, you know, we understand how government works. We understand how power works. I mean, this is so much the subject of your show. State power is, you know, that is how the world works. But what has happened is there has been an alternative center of power that has grown up, and that is Silicon Valley. And basically, over a very, very short period of time, they have amassed a huge amount of knowledge and therefore power over us, over the entire population of the world. And they've done that because they gave us things that, you know, we thought we wanted. You know, they gave us great products, great services, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Google search. But now what we're seeing is that these companies, with this huge amount of knowledge about every aspect of our lives, are now allying themselves with the US government, with what we can see is an authoritarian regime. I mean, I hesitate to use that word, but that is what the US is becoming. And now this is a new type of power, and this is, the world hasn't seen this before, in which you have state power now with this enormous surveillance engine machine, which is Silicon Valley. And it's the coming together of these two things, which I think is a totally terrifying new reality that you are experiencing first in the US here, but actually other authoritarian countries have already, they're ahead of you in some ways, and this is now spreading across the world.
I mean, in fact, you make an analogy in your TED Talk in April, just earlier this year, between what's happened in Russia and what's happening now in the U.S., and you warn these tech bros, saying that, you know, you cannot ally yourself with an autocrat, believing that you will be protected. So if you could elaborate on that and how you see this analogy working, I mean, the business elite allied with, as you said, autocrats elsewhere, and what form you see it taking here.
So I think you're in the US, you're in a more vulnerable position even than people in Russia. Because so what we saw when Putin took power, there was initially, he let the oligarchs, he let this business elite, he let them alone, like, make money and I will leave you alone. I'm going to, you know, that you're going to have the power to build, you know, through massive illegality and corruption, to grow these vast, enormous amounts of wealth. But then came the crackdown, and he increasingly, if they didn't do exactly what he wanted, if they didn't support him in every way, well, then they suffered for it. And in cases, you know, this guy, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Putin fell out with him and exiled him to Siberia for a decade. You know, another oligarch, Boris Berezovsky, you know, he was killed in mysterious circumstances. So this idea that the leaders of these tech companies, you know, think that by sucking up and cozying up to Trump, that it's all going to be golden, they're just going to make vast fortunes, I think that, I hope they see as an erroneous belief. But also, I think, for the American people, is that these were just business leaders in the US. What is different in Russia, what is different in the US, is that these are companies which are integrated into all of our lives. And so that, for me, is the thing which is profoundly, profoundly troubling, which is you have the machinery of a surveillance society, which is now being, as I say, enmeshed with this increasingly authoritarian government.
So talk about, I mean, with Cambridge Analytica, which you helped expose, they were providing information to Brexit, and you would ultimately be sued by one of the financiers. The vice president was Steve Bannon, who is a key ally of President Trump. Now here in the United States, you've got Palantir. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the Trump administration tapping this data mining company founded by the billionaire tech investor like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, South African, to compile data on people in the United States for a master database, and why this is so dangerous.
So I think, you know, what was the good thing, if I can say this, about Elon Musk, is that he made the threat from these Silicon Valley companies visible for the first time. We now know who Elon Musk is. We now know how dangerous he is. And I think we now have to go through the same process with understanding who this guy, Peter Thiel, is, and this company, Palantir. And one thing to know is that Peter Thiel and Elon Musk were business partners. They go way back. They actually founded PayPal together, which is, you know, the online money transfer system. There is a small bunch of people who have, with very similar ideas, essentially been on this power grab. And what we have seen happen in the last few months is a rapid, an unaccountable and illegal harvesting of different, DOGE went into different government offices, and in, you know, we saw it in the US Treasury first. That was an illegal access to those computers, at which point DOGE took that data. Now, that pattern has been repeated in departments across the federal government. New York Times said, I think it was 314 different databases which were taken. That has now been merged together, and now Palantir is being brought in. So Palantir, the first thing you should know about it, you've just been watching these incredible reports from about Gaza and Palestine. Palantir is a military contractor. It is being used by the Israeli government to find people, to profile them, to pick out targets and to eliminate them. And the CEO of Palantir, a guy called Alex Karp, has said that out loud. He said, this is what we do. He said, when necessary, we kill people. That is now the company that is in the heart of the US federal government. That is the company now which has the data of every citizen in this country. And I think, you know, people should be freaked out, okay? If you're not freaking out yet, you should be. Because this, we have seen there is a pattern across history, across the world, which is this is what authoritarians do. They want as much information about the population as possible so that they can surveil them, they can control them, they can search out their enemies, they can target them, and they can punish them, and they can silence them. That process has already started in the US, and we see it in the US amongst the most vulnerable population. We see it happening to immigrants. We see it happening to foreign students. Now, that is just the test case, because these are the people with the fewest rights. But what happens to them is now going to come to other people.
We're going to do part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Carol Cadwalader, award-winning investigative journalist, her Substack, How to Survive the Broligarchy. And we will link to her pieces, The Dark Lord of Silicon Valley. Peter Thiel enters the chat. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.